everyone. I'm Tip Pichot, and welcome to the Liberty Advisor Podcast, Crypto Wealth Edition, episode number 3. As we record, it is December 11th, 2018, and we are deep into this crypto bear market. Today's guest is Andrew Kiegel, who is the CEO of Hut 8, which is the largest publicly traded Bitcoin or actually cryptocurrency mining company in the world. And with today, with the price of Bitcoin as low as it is relative to the cost of mining, I couldn't think of a better person to interview. And this is definitely an interview you won't want to miss. A lot of people know that I'm pretty tied into Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And even I learned some new things today in this podcast, and I think you'll learn some new things as well. So now without further ado, let's get into the podcast. So today we are joined by Andrew Kiegel, who is the CEO and co-founder of Hut 8 Mining. Hut 8 is the largest publicly trading mining company in the world. Since I am a financial advisor, everyone always does these and says, well, I'm not a financial advisor. Well, unfortunately, I am a financial advisor. So I've got to point out that this is for informational purposes only. And that by mentioning Hut 8, I'm not saying, hey, go out and buy it. Talk to your own advisor. And if you don't have one or you don't like them or your advisor thinks that crypto is worthless, then talk to me. So there's a shameless plug and the CYA all in one shot. But Hut 8 trades under the ticker symbol HUTMF, where you can find them on the over-the-counter markets. Before joining Hut 8, Andrew came from the investment banking world, where he was with GMP Securities LP. And while he was there, he played an integral role and was a key member in the blockchain investment group. Andrew has extensive experience in providing investment banking services to numerous public and private entities, including raising capital and debt in excess of over $3 billion in the last 5 years. As it stands today, Hut 8 is trading around the $1.50 range, and they have a market cap of $128 million. But before we get into Hut 8, before we get into Andrew, I wanted to point out how timely this interview is. We've got the likes of MarketWatch, which is now claiming that Bitcoin is going to be worthless. Basically, the premise of their article is, hey, if it costs, let's say, $5,000 to mine Bitcoin, and today Bitcoin, last time I checked, was around $3,300, then ultimately Bitcoin is going to be worthless because why would you mine Bitcoin if you're going to, you know, lose money doing something? So we're in this weird point where we've got this backwardation, where and that's a fancy term for, you know, hey, you know, it costs more to mine it than it does to actually sell it. And that wasn't always the case. That isn't always, you know, that isn't how things always work. And I figure, you know, what better person to basically, you know, kind of tear this apart 7 ways to Sunday than the CEO of the largest publicly trading mining company in the world. So we'd like to welcome Andrew to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Thank you. So what do you have to say about, you know, like the likes of MarketWatch, which is saying that Bitcoin is now entering a death spiral and is becoming going to come completely worthless, all because of the mining aspects of the math, how it works out today?
Yeah, so what I would say is what's been said, it's definitely not in a death spiral. The cost of mining a Bitcoin, certainly for today, for most people, not all, I'd say 75% of the miners out there, is higher than the actual price of Bitcoin. But I think you have to go back and really explore, you know, why you need Bitcoin. And if you look at places today, you know, some of the biggest adopters in the world of Bitcoin today are Argentina and Venezuela. And the reason why is you look at the inflation rate there and the government restrictions against them being able to move their capital make something like Bitcoin very attractive. It's a digital gold and it's a digital currency. It's still in its infancy and it's evolving, but that's the purpose that it serves. It's borderless and it functions all over the world. And so for someone to say that it's a death spiral just because there's a temporary imbalance in the cost, it doesn't really make sense. There's still billions of dollars of Bitcoin traded daily. If we look at what's happening all over the world right now, is there's a big fear of inflation. And that's happening in the US, it's happening in Canada, it's happening everywhere. And one of the reasons for this is that fiat currencies are no longer backed by anything. It's really just backed based on a government saying, hey, trust us, this is worth something. And when there's problems that are happening in and around the world, like for example, France, where the value of the currency continues to devalue and there's unrest that's happening there, this is all because of, you know, bad fiscal policy over the last, you know, several decades. So Bitcoin is not a death spiral. It's definitely not going to zero. If we look around, let's look at what are the smart hands doing here. You have Goldman Sachs and Galaxy, who are creating a custodial service called BitGo. Fidelity, I believe they're the third largest asset manager in the world. Certainly guys that know what they're doing are setting up custodial services and trading desks. The New York Stock Exchange is setting up a futures desk. The NASDAQ is looking into this. These are all very smart groups.
Yeah.
I mean, the NYC is the largest exchange in the world and the NASDAQ is the second largest in the world. If this was going in some kind of a death spiral, why are they investing so much money into setting up platforms here? So, you know, I think you have to think about it this way. And I heard a great quote actually today, which is technology always under delivers in the short term and over delivers in the long term. You know, think back to Amazon when it was trading at $7 and a lot of people were saying, yeah, this internet thing's just not working out. You know, and you look forward and you see the uses and where these companies have grown. So I think it's really a naive statement to say that there's a death spiral or it's going to zero. I think that's coming from people that don't understand what Bitcoin is or what miners do.
No, and I think that is a great quote, and that's definitely some great insight that you provided us. And just don't tell anybody don't tell Paul Krugman that the internet is still around today. And then we also have the likes of, even Bill Gates, I mean, who the guy that should know better. I think he said I don't know the exact time frame, but he said, you know, why would anyone ever need more than like 56K of RAM? And so even guys who are pretty smart in their own fields don't always know what they're talking about. And another big institution that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily call dumb money would be Yale, threw down, $400 million.
That's right.
Blockchain Enterprise Fund. So, I mean, Yale is going to they're not just throwing money, you know, away. You've got, I'm trying to think of the, I lost my train of thought there, but you know, you got big JP Morgan, over 170 patents that they've applied for, while at the same time, Jamie Dimon is bad mouthing Bitcoin. So it's just, you know,
right.
Don't pay attention to what I'm saying, pay attention to what I'm doing. And if you pay attention to what smart money doing, even the Rothschild family was starting to get into, and they even asked, you know, Jeff Berwick of all people, it's different advice on how to get into, the crypto markets. So it is definitely an exciting time.
Well, yeah, for sure. And what I would say is if, you know, to your listeners and viewers, if you look forward 10 years, it would be hard for me to imagine. Right now, the currency trade market is about $5 trillion a day in currency trading daily. The U.S. government spends something like $30, $40 million a day in just printing paper currency. It's really hard for me to imagine that in 10 years, there's not going to be some type of a global currency that is borderless and outside of the control of governments being able to continue to print it and put their economies in jeopardy through bad fiscal policy. And right now, Bitcoin stands to be the incumbent to take that role. It's a digital gold.
Now, do you think there's also the risk that, you know, this technology is going to be hijacked where, you know, the governments or, you know, the Goldman Sachs, the Federal Reserve, central banks around the world are now going to use this technology of basically the blockchain technology to sort of have like their one world government where, you know, because you kind of have two different paths that could be laid out. One's the, you know, the borderless, permissionless type currency, but then there's also the people that are clamoring for more regulation, which then could lead it to a situation where, hey, you know, now we're on like the Goldman Sachs .gov coin. And I sort of see that as one potential outcome, but it's just up to the community of which one that they'd rather use. And for me, I'd rather use one that's not tracked and traced and surveilled and under the control of the government, especially when you can just print money at will, or now they don't even print it. I was surprised they even spent $30 million. Was that a day or a month that you mentioned?
I think it's a day. Yeah. I wrote an article on this recently, and the amount of money that is used in just keeping the fiat currencies going is astronomical. But to your question, you know, why can't the government? So number one, regulation is good. And in the world of cryptocurrencies, the SEC earlier this year, I believe it was July, came out and they sort of deemed Bitcoin to be a commodity. And it's now regulated by the Commodity Futures Exchange. And that's a good thing. Essentially, what they're saying is they're grandfathering Bitcoin because it is so large. But I think where the reason blockchain is so powerful is, you know, Tim, if I'm sending you a Bitcoin, it's not going to be Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan or the US Fed that's going to deal with that. This is a group of computers all over the world that says, yep, we're going to move this from Andrew Kegel's ledger and move it to Tim's. And then everybody validates that, they confirm it, and the move is made. And I think the ability to do that without having someone who can come in and manipulate it, because it's really based on a mathematical algorithm, is very powerful.
Yeah, and I'll provide my Bitcoin address below if you do want to send me.
Sure.
But I guess, you know, probably like shift gears, you know, into more of what, you know, Hut 8 Mining is doing. And actually, you know, maybe a quick overview, because I'm going to have clients who are, or not clients, but also clients and viewers who initially this started, I was the Liberty Advisor podcast, or that's what the podcast was called. It was doing a lot with politics and the stock market. And then what I found out is some people are like, well, hey, you know, I don't really care about cryptocurrency. So now I have a crypto editions. So there is going to be some crossover where people might be, have like no idea what we're even talking about. So I hate, you know, kind of, you know, asking the CEO of the world's largest publicly traded company, you know, kind of give us the basics of mining, but could you give us, you know, a quick overview of mining for maybe those listeners who are now are just finding out what mining is for the first time and why it's important and what role Hut 8 plays in all that?
Sure. So mining is, it's not the best term, but essentially what happens is, it is back to that example, which is if I'm sending you, Tim, we're doing a transaction together in Bitcoin, and you have all these computers all over the world that are validating the movement of that Bitcoin from me to you, and it's done in this public ledger called the blockchain. And it actually, contrary to what you said before, it's actually very traceable. It's very transparent. You can see where the money is going, where it sits, and it's part of this large public ledger that anyone can view that sits on the cloud. And so in order to incent these computers to provide this security, the validation, really to enable this borderless currency storage of value all over the world without having a government or a financial institution monitoring it and have the ability to manipulate it, is that incentive is to reward people in additional Bitcoin. And that is what the mining process is. So Hut 8 is, we're the largest publicly traded Bitcoin mining company in the world, or cryptocurrency mining. I believe we are the largest public or private in North America. I'm for sure the largest in Canada. I have yet to come across anybody larger than us in the US. But essentially what we do is we have these mining farms, which are these supercomputers that we have set up. They're in very remote areas to take advantage of stranded energy. So this is energy that is not necessarily being used by anybody else. It's excess that we go in and we negotiate prices from, you know, free and willing sellers. And we use these supercomputers really to provide this service of securing the Bitcoin blockchain. So the transactions as they occur, we participate in that, and in exchange, we receive back Bitcoin, and that's our business model. That's all we do.
Oh, and thank you for that introduction, or for that overview of the process. And is there things that make what you guys do different than, you know, other maybe mining groups that are out there, or other mining pools, or people want to just, you know, let's say I've got a friend who's got 30 S9s in, you know, his garage right now. I mean, because right now, I mean, a lot of those people have been sort of shut out, where it costs more, since it costs more to mine, they can't, you know, afford pay an extra, maybe eat $5,000 a month. Whereas, you know, it sounds like with some of the technological partnerships you have with Bitfury and the software you guys have and the ability to, you know, go to places where it has cheap energy, that you have certain economies of scale and efficiencies that the average person out there just isn't able to realize.
Yeah. So when I was an investment banker, I was raising a lot of money for different blockchain companies, and I got to see some of the flaws in the other companies. And we said, if we're going to do this, let's create something that is better, superior to what other people are doing. And you're right. This has moved from being something people used to do in their basements or their dorm rooms to industrial scale. So number one, we want to have access to the technology and a very strong partner. We approach Bitfury. They own 45% of our company. For the listeners out there, Bitfury is the second largest ASIC chip manufacturer in the world. The ASIC chip is a special chip used for Bitcoin mining. And so we have them as a very large partner, and they supply us the equipment and the hardware and the servicing to operate our supercomputers, which are all located in Alberta, Canada right now. And I'll get into why we're there a little bit later. But that alignment with Bitfury is very powerful. So number one, when we purchase equipment from them, they take back a portion of what we buy from them in stock. So that keeps them aligned. It means we're getting the most up-to-date chips, we're getting things on time, and we have them backing it and validating what we're doing there. So it's got a sort of a warranty on it from them. Number two, we said, rather than going and trying to find small pieces of electricity and overpaying, we went and we signed, and this is the only one of its kind that I've seen, is a long-term contract in the city of Medicine Hat, Alberta, for long-term electricity. We have a 10-year contract there that guarantees us a power supply. So these are two things that I think are very different than what other people have going right now. So, you know, back to your friend that might have a bunch of S9s sitting in a warehouse somewhere or in you know, some spot, we're operating at a very large scale. So we're running, by the end of this year, we'll be at 100 megawatts, which is quite large. So it's about over 800 petahash a second that we're doing. So it's 800 quadrillion attempts to help validate the blockchain every second.
And that's just you guys, not the entire market.
That's just us. That's just us.
And it was probably not too long ago that the entire market was at 800 quadrillion. And so it's just amazing to see the you know, the exponential curve of how the hash rate has increased, especially the past year.
Yes, although it's decreased by, it looks like it's going to end up decreasing on the next turn in about 7 days. Since mid-October, it'll have decreased about 50%. So that's beneficial to guys like us.
And that's something that, you know, the MarketWatch article doesn't really get into, or that's one of the other ways to dispel what the MarketWatch article was talking about, is that they didn't, you know, people that aren't really in the know don't realize that there's difficulty adjustments, and that, you know, usually about every, what is it, 2 weeks or so, the difficulty is going to change. And so, you know, given that, I mean, I have to imagine that the difficulty adjustment is going to go down, you know, quite a bit. And then at that point, it won't cost as much to mine. And so there's this natural equilibrium of when all of a sudden it drops low enough, then you're incentivizing more people to jump in, or when the price goes higher, it's then going to incentivize more people to jump in relative to the price. And that's something that I imagine that with your guys' software and ability to have, you know, those guaranteed power contracts comes into play. Cause I'm originally from Syracuse, New York, which is basically, you know, right across, you know, the lake, or I guess Rochester is probably right across the lake from Toronto. And, you know, up there, you know, it's, I'd be, you know, sort of iffy if you want to open up any crypto mining companies in New York, because they can always come in and say, hey, you know, you guys are stealing energy from us, and now you're making the town's energy cost more. And so we're going to put, you know, ridiculous tax on you guys, or say you're not even allowed to operate. And so I imagine that's probably one of the reasons why you're operating in Canada and not, you know, across the lake in New York, for instance.
Yeah, no, for sure. So Bitcoin miners are somewhat indifferent to where they're located. And so in places like Canada and the northern US, those are ideal climates. Again, also because we're somewhat indifferent as to where we need to be, we can choose remote areas that have stranded energy. And so, for example, in Medicine Hat was producing, you know, multiples of the, you know, megawatts above what the citizens required there. And so as a result, we were able to go in there and negotiate a contract with them, really to take their stranded energy. And, you know, I was reading an article last night that said 77% of Bitcoin mining around the world is in remote areas and uses renewable energy. And so in many senses, we're going out there and taking energy that would otherwise be wasted, and we're converting energy into a digital currency that can be spent or used for storage of value. And that's something that, you know, a lot of other industries don't do. So I would argue that Bitcoin mining is amongst the cleanest industrial uses of electricity in the world.
And you probably also have a lot of innovation going on in the energy space as well, where, you know, if you are incentivized to, you know, get energy for as cheap as possible, there's people out there who are going to be, you know, hey, how can we recycle this heat and do other things with the heat? Or I know that.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, that's another question is, do you guys do anything with the excess heat? I mean, is it used to, you know, basically kind of like warm the facility a little bit, or imagine there, you know, is there a facility, or do you guys have, you know, like the shipping crates where you can move them around, or can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. So we don't recycle our heat. We don't produce enough heat really to recycle, but we also use these shipping containers. So our facilities are all based on shipping containers. So we have 86 of these shipping containers. Each one uses about 1.2 megawatts of electricity. And if you go to our website, which is hut8mining.com, you'll see how they're laid out. They're very symmetrical and laid out in a large field, really in a very remote area. And so they're fan cooled. There's no air, electricity used for air conditioning in those. And we just release the excess heat into the air, but it's not that much.
Okay. Can you sort of quantify for us, you know, the amount of electricity you guys are using? So, I mean, you throw out different megawatt numbers, but is that like, you know, a city of, you know, 100,000 people or 50,000? Or do you have any sort of, you know, comparable metric for the layperson out there?
Yeah, so it's hard to quantify because it depends on the time of day and the time of year. But what I would say is In a city like Medicine Hat, which has about 65,000 people, at their peak use would probably be about equivalent to what we're using. So call it during a heat wave in the summer when, you know, all the air conditioners are turned on, that would probably be equivalent to what we're using. So call it a city of 65,000 people.
Oh, thank you for that. And right now, do you guys only mine Bitcoin, or would you look into other cryptos in the future? Or right now, is the sole focus on Bitcoin?
We only mine Bitcoin. And the reason why is if I was to look 5 years down the road, there's a lot of different currencies out there. If I was to look 5 years down the road and with some level of certainty, I know that the cryptocurrency market will be there, but which cryptocurrencies will survive? The only one I can really be sure of is Bitcoin. And the correlation between Bitcoin and everything else is so high. I mean, Bitcoin is really the godfather. It was the first cryptocurrency. Its market cap is larger than all the other ones put together. So really, as a public company, we're just trying to provide people with exposure to Bitcoin without actually having to go through the process of, you know, creating online wallets and transfer personal information online.
And so is the Bitcoin you guys mine, you know, basically you guys are, you know, say like hodlers of it, where, you know, part of the value of the company is, hey, we're acquiring this Bitcoin. And then, and as there's, you know, transaction fees and as, you know, the backwardation process reverses and it becomes more profitable again, you know, across the board, you know, is that what's really sort of driving stock price? And I got to imagine that the correlation between the Bitcoin price and your stock price has to be pretty highly correlated, like an overstock.com or another company that's very correlated to the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're over 80% correlated to the price of Bitcoin. And so our share price has tracked Bitcoin this year, which has not been great, but nonetheless, that was the exposure we told shareholders we were going to provide. And so the share price is doing what we said. Our standpoint is we mine the Bitcoin, we sell the whatever amount it is we need to cover our overhead. Obviously, we have to pay for electricity and fiat currency, and then the rest we hold.
Okay, and I do have some listener questions where I posted this on Facebook, and some different people in the industry had, if you wouldn't mind. So we got about 8 questions
in
7 minutes, so maybe, you know, lightning round over here. So we got Pace Ellsworth of Helium, and that's Helium with an E. I think there's two of them. But, you know, how do you think proof of work will evolve over time? Does it need to? And how are you preparing for the future of mining? And he also gets into, you know, do you think environmental regulations pose the biggest threat to proof of mining, which we sort of already touched on with the 77% coming from renewables. But do you have any thoughts on how proof of work might, how that might evolve over time?
Yeah, I think proof of work is here to stay for Bitcoin. I know there's lots of talk in Ethereum about moving to proof of stake. That's a whole other podcast to get into the differences between that. But it's the proof of work is what provides that validation for the transactions. And I think it would be very difficult, given this is the largest blockchain in the world, to alter what makes Bitcoin so good, which is the level of strength and the security. So I don't think it's moving. But what I think we're going to see on the energy side is the Bitcoin miners are always looking for the cheapest sources of energy. So often that's stranded or excess energy. And what I would say is we're in the process of installing 12 new boxes with new chip technology. And what we're finding on those is we're able to mine 50% more coin from the same configuration, but using 20% less energy. So as the Bitcoin mining evolves, I think what you're gonna see is not a move away from proof of work, but what you're gonna see is evolutions in the way the technology harnesses the energy. So we'll be able to harness less energy and produce more coin.
Now, and I think for some of these other smaller coins, I mean, I think they have a problem with proof of work because you see 51% attacks and where you can just,
for sure,
cash power from one place and move it to another. That, I think when it comes to the Bitcoin, you know, no government or no one's going to be able to really overtake that 51% attack. I mean, I sort of have my own question I just thought up right now. I mean, do you think quantum computing could be a threat in the future? Or is that kind of so far away that that we're going to have quantum on our side too in order to combat what could be going on?
I've heard that a lot. I mean, I've had conversations with some very strong engineering technologists, and they just say that even if it, once it comes around, it's just going to be impossible to implement quantum computing into sort of doing a 51% attack into the Bitcoin world. So we'll see how things evolve, but I still think that's years away from being something. And again, I don't know if that's something that's more propaganda by people trying to scare people out of the Bitcoin world.
Okay. And then we've got another question that's coming in from a fellow Canadian, John Thor Stubbs-Neeson of World Alternative Media. So I can, if you're interested, I can try to hook you up with them. They've got almost 100,000 subscribers on YouTube.
And have absolutely
been up, Bitcoin lately. I think they've got like about 7,000 new subscribers this week. That'd be a great, great connection over there. But he asked, are they offering cloud mining? If so, the investment in mining ends up in loss with the cost of electricity rising. How do you make your investors make money? And it sounds like you're not doing cloud mining.
We do not do cloud mining. We don't sell our hash rate. It's owned by the equity holders in our stock. And we do it all ourselves because, you know, he's absolutely right. People who are doing cloud mining or buying hash rate from other people that are doing for them are not making any money. I mean, they're paying twice as much per coin as it costs us to make a coin.
Yeah, that definitely doesn't work out.
So maybe, I saw a press release the other day from a company that was buying some hash rate, and that they're doing it all via a third party, so cloud mining, and they said they were paying 7.3 cents US per kilowatt hour. And I can tell you, our costs on the majority of our facilities are near just over 3 cents. So that's 80% of your cost. So put that in perspective, that's more than twice as much as what they're paying to have somebody else do it rather than us just doing that ourselves.
No, that's definitely great insight. And then Alexander McKean of Blue Wave Crypto, I think you kind of already touched on this as well, but he wanted to know comments on proof of stake as Ethereum makes a transition and thoughts on decentralized exchanges. But, you know, it sounds like that's sort of like a whole another can of worms that we'd have to get into.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole different area, and you know, I can chat about that, but I feel like that would take me 20 minutes just to sort of get into that.
And that's why I was kind of smiling as I was saying, because I know that that's a tough one. So we've got the last person writing in here, and it looks like he has a couple questions. It's Chris Karabatz, Smart Cash, was wondering what's your opinions on ASIC resistance and proof of work coins, and does he think that's a useful attribute to aim for in the long run? And it sort of sounds like basically we're only sticking with Bitcoin, so it doesn't even matter what the other ones are because they're not big enough.
Yeah. I mean, we've looked at everything. We've looked, and we know there's the Bitcoin Cash, and there was a big hash war there that's been ongoing for the last month. And we've looked at the different things. It's not really an area we've chosen to step into. When we created the company, it was really to provide people access and exposure directly to Bitcoin, and not we're not looking to be a diversified company of different cryptocurrencies. We believe in Bitcoin Core. That's where we're going to stick. And our view is we're going to continue to sort of use, you know, the most up-to-date and efficient chips we can in order to do that.
Now, it almost seems like this is a sort of a layup for you guys. This next question that I swear, you guys didn't pay us to write this one, but he asked, you know, do you see any potential risk to coins that are entirely or mostly mined by hardware built by one company, particularly if that company is beholden to the Chinese government? And I think I know what company he's talking about.
Yes. So, you know, there's a few things. So obviously referring to Bitmain, I see the dominance of Bitmain diminishing here. You can see it right now. They were talking about doing an IPO. From what I see, that's going to get shelved from what I'm hearing. The other piece of it is while they make a very good efficient machine, you know, the S-Series, the S9s is a good machine. The longevity of the machine, when I talk to engineers, is in question. And so what I see is, particularly with what we're using, is that the playing field is getting broader and more outside China. I think a lot of miners are leaving China. The Chinese government is really clamping down on the use of electricity for this stuff, because obviously with so many people, it's more of a concern for them. I see that the dominance will go away from being one player that controls 80% of the market and will maybe be spread across 6 to 8 that will each control a more reasonable amount.
And that should be good for everybody, because then, you know, competition will help, you know, drive efficiencies in the space. And the last viewer question here we have is, do you see any risk with governments blacklisting addresses and forcing the big miners to not accept any transactions from those addresses? We recently had the Iranian who, I think it was the U.S. government, blacklisted them for
something to do like a SAM virus that was going around?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that before, but certainly it's possible. What I would say is, if somebody was looking to do things that were fraudulent or terror related, Bitcoin is really a poor choice of cryptocurrency. There's better stuff out there like Monero, which preserves the privacy. But by all means, if the government was to come to us and say, you know, we didn't want Hut 8 doing transactions with so and we were shown evidence, we would certainly be more than happy to comply with that. We haven't had that issue. All the coin we mine is freshly minted. And so we don't accept or do transactions really in Bitcoin. So it's not really a question I've really given a lot of thought to.
Okay. And just want to point out that the vehicle that is most used in terrorist financing is actually the US dollar. So, I
mean, absolutely the US dollar.
The government wants to start, you know, pointing fingers. You know, there's the biggest finger to point. And then I guess last question here, and this is my own. Do you think that the Bitcoin Cash, you know, hash war, ABC versus SV, that's one of the main driving forces? Because we do have Craig Wright coming out and saying, you know, hey, you know, we'll drive this down to $1,000, or, you know, we'll drive it down to close to zero if need be. I mean, a lot of it just sounds like, you know, BS and bluster coming out of one side. I imagine that's got to be, you know, sort of the, you know, the FUD, the fear, uncertainty, doubt that's creating what's going on right now today in the market.
I think for sure that's a big portion of what's happened here. You know, we had the big drop from, you know, 19,000 down to that $6,500 range. It was very stable there for a long time, even while the traditional capital markets were capitulating. And then that all started and it's now dropped into that $3,500 range. So certainly there's an impact there. I don't think it's from them necessarily dumping coin. I think it's from them creating the FUD, right? The fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And so I'm looking at the, you know, this to me is a great opportunity to be buying Bitcoin. And if you don't have the sophistication to buy it, to be buying stocks like Hut 8. If I look at 2019, there's just the writing is on the wall. You know, you've got Goldman Sachs moving in there, Fidelity, New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ. You have this whole thing, the insurance companies, the auditors, everybody is positioning themselves here, not in all cryptocurrencies, primarily in Bitcoin. And the reason why is I think they see the value in having this borderless gold-like currency that can be used anywhere in the world. And so, you know, I think this is all temporary. I think that the current, you know, cost of Bitcoin mining and the economics is a temporary phenomenon. And, you know, I'm not concerned about it in the longer term.
Yeah, we're very thankful for all of your insights today. I think it's been a great interview, very knowledgeable. I know I've learned some stuff, which means that I'm sure anyone watching this has learned things as well. And, you know, we're very gracious of your time. I know we're at 33 minutes now. So we do want to thank you for being on the podcast and thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, with pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Why would anybody want to buy Bitcoin inside their IRA? I mean, the whole point of Bitcoin was to have peer-to-peer electronic cash. So why are you going to have a financial intermediary buy Bitcoin for you? Why don't you just cash out your 401k, cash out your IRA, cash out your retirement plan, and just buy Bitcoin on your own? Well, the reason for that is if somebody had January 1st, 2017, invested $100,000 into Bitcoin, and then 1 year later, they would have had, after taxes and the 10% penalty, they would have just under $900,000. So you would have turned $100,000 into close to $900,000. So you're obviously doing something right. However, there is a better way that they could have done it. What they could have done is they could have done a Roth conversion. With a Roth conversion, you save the 10% penalty. So you've got 10% more that could be invested into crypto. And the beauty of this is that now all of your gains are now forever tax-free. So you put the $100,000 in, and now, again, you're getting out of paying the 10% penalty. And now, after even all my management fees, you now have a little over $1 million. We have all the exact specific numbers linked down or should be on the screen right now. I don't have it memorized. But, you know, to me, you know, $1 million sounds a little bit better than $900,000. And having tax-free gains forever sounds better than having $900,000 that now any appreciation or hopeful potential appreciation would then be subject to tax. And the other reason why we thought of this, or really the genesis of this, is I had heard a lot of people doing this, and I thought that, hey, there's got to be a better way. But the main reason is you've got a lot of people who the only money they have to invest is inside of their retirement accounts. A lot of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, even people who have million-dollar IRAs, a lot of them don't have actual extra money to invest. They don't have rainy day funds. And the rainy day funds should be kept in actual safe, liquid, you know, basically cash or really short-term treasury bills. It shouldn't be invested into Bitcoin. And so a lot of people just don't have that extra money to invest. And so taking a small percentage of your IRA or 401k and then, you know, putting it into Bitcoin, if you know what you're doing and you understand the risk and you actually believe in this philosophically, is actually, I think, you know, a good move to make. So again, if you're going to pull money out of your 401k to buy Bitcoin, you should talk to myself, because I think that the Roth IRA conversion is a much better way of doing things. And that is why somebody would want to consider having Bitcoin inside their IRA as opposed to cashing out their 401k and just buying it outright.
Okay, well, that's great. You've got people who have IRAs and 401ks, and you know, there's different things you can do or that I can do to help them out. But what about the person that has maybe a few million dollars of gains and they bought it on Coinbase or Kraken, or they got several millions of dollars of gains and all of a sudden now you want to go buy your Lambo or buy a new house? I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to skirt around the IRS, because they're going to wonder, you know, hey, how'd you get that $500,000 to buy a new house? Well, for those people, probably the best person to explain this is actually my friend Ernest Hancock, as he was giving me an introduction at Anarchapoco. Anyways, I'll let Ernie take it away, because we can also have advanced trust strategies for the people that have millions of dollars of gains. This is not just for people who are looking to invest parts of their IRAs or 401ks.
A good friend of mine, Tim Pachote, he's a financial advisor at Scottsdale. He'll be speaking at the TDV event. You'd be able to bring the crypto into the system. How would you be able to do a foundation, a trust, a this, a that, and so on? And Tim was at the party. I go, Tim, what up? He's been spending months that he's getting ready to present to you guys Monday on how you can take your crypto and not pay capital gains on it, not have taxes on it. I'm going, man, you need to talk to Tim.